bring in Lester Munson, who is on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, our legal analyst, who we think does an excellent job explaining this stuff in ways that those of us who don't know a lot about the law can understand. So, Lester, good morning and welcome. And I want to start with that. Both Mike and I were struck by how far the district attorney went yesterday in essentially saying, look, I think Ben Roethlisberger did a lot of bad things here, but I just can't prove a crime was committed. How unusual would you say some of the comments the DA made yesterday really are in terms of cases like these?
He was unusually candid in showing his disgust with Roethlisberger. There is no question about that. He made sure, both in the statement that he had prepared and in his answers to the reporter's questions, that everybody understood that he viewed Roethlisberger's conduct that night as reprehensible, as unacceptable. And I got the feeling that the prosecutor really wanted to file a charge against Roethlisberger, but as a professional, he realized he could not do it. The witness, the young woman accuser, was simply so drunk that she could not remember much of what happened, and when she tried to remember, she couldn't keep the story straight. She was at the brownout, blackout level of drunkenness, so therefore there could be no charge.
Why did he do it then? Why did the DA go so far as to give all those details?
I think that when he went through all the statements, Mike, and he saw what had gone on for the entire evening, he saw behavior that he did not want to see again in his jurisdiction. Roethlisberger and his crew were going from place to place. They were 8 and 10 years older than all the students who were hanging out at these places. He was using his celebrity and his fame to draw people into the VIP room. This guy, Bright, he appears to be a very professional prosecutor, and he was clearly disgusted and well beyond annoyed with what he saw.
Mike and Lester Munson. So I guess now that the district attorney has decided not to file charges, the question, Lester, would be, is this part of it completely over for Ben Roethlisberger?
No, I don't think so. If you read the letter that the woman's lawyer wrote, you can go between the lines of that letter and you can see that they are going to do something with Roethlisberger. They're going to make a claim. My prediction would be, and it's a guess more than a prediction, my prediction would be that she's going to try to settle with him for everything that he has put her through. She may not reach the stage of a lawsuit like the woman in Nevada. If Roethlisberger is thinking clearly, and I know that he's got a great lawyer, Ed Garland, in Atlanta, if he follows the lawyer's advice, he will try to settle with her very quickly before something else goes public here, and then he can face Roger Goodell and the Rooney family and try and see what happens with them.
If you're representing him, though, Lester, and Ben says to you, Lester, I don't want to settle. I, we got carried away in a bathroom. I didn't do anything wrong here. You may convict me of bad decision. I don't want to settle because if I settle, it's going to look like guilt and I'm trying to buy her off. I don't want to do that. What advice would you give him?
My advice to him would be to reconsider that position very carefully and to turn around and go the other way. I don't think Roethlisberger can withstand much more of this negative publicity. If he wants to show that he is making changes and that he's going to be some sort of new person, that he has had a kind of an awakening here, then he should be settling with her, and he should probably take a hard look at settling the case in Nevada. In Nevada, he took a righteous attack position trying to knock out that case real early. That did not work for him in Nevada, and I'm not sure it would work for him in Georgia either if she were to file the case.
And if he decides not to settle, and has already been established that this girl was, as you just mentioned, the brownout, blackout stage of being drunk, do you think that she could build a civil case against him?
I think she can build a civil case using the injuries that were found in the emergency room, the blood, the laceration, the bruises. Based on that, based on medical testimony, based on testimony from some of the people who were with her that night, she could make a civil case. You couldn't make a criminal case because the burden of proof is so much greater in a criminal case. But yes, I believe that she and her lawyers could put together a civil case in which she would show that what she is saying is more probably true than what Roethlisberger is denying.
Mike and Lester Munson, who's with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Build your better breakfast at Subway with the $2.50 breakfast combo only at Subway. Many around the country may not know that Lester not only covers the law and is a legal analyst, but also covers sports. And there is a sports angle to this that I would like to get your perspective. Lester, can you hang on a minute?
Yes.
Let's turn our attention to what the football fan is concerned with now. Ben Roethlisberger will meet with Roger Goodell. He has never been charged with a crime, much less convicted of a crime. So the question, Lester, is, in the absence of even having been charged with a crime, do you think the commissioner can suspend him?
Yes, he can. The personal conduct policy was written with, it seems, this exact situation in mind. The policy states it is not enough simply to avoid being found guilty of a crime. He has avoided being found guilty. He has avoided even being charged with a crime. And as the policy says, that is not enough. So that when he meets with Goodell, number one, he's going to have some explaining to do. And number two, Goodell clearly has the authority to suspend him. Obviously, Roethlisberger would have the right to file a grievance using the union and his own lawyers to pursue the grievance, but clearly Goodell has this authority, and as we know, he has been somewhat aggressive in using that power.
He absolutely has, and as we're going through some of the other players that have been suspended for this policy, we're trying to find if anybody, if Ben does get suspended, would have been suspended for doing less, you know, not being charged in less than Ben. And right now we're going to have more Chris Mortensen on later to go through that. But we can't find anybody at this point who's done less than Ben Roethlisberger and been suspended. So if Roger Goodell does suspend him, if you were running the union, would you step in on this one?
I think I might. I think that the new leader of the union, I think he needs to establish himself as the leader. I think this would probably be a good case to show that he is a player's guy, that he stands for his players, even under this level of unsavory and adverse circumstances. I think when you're running a union, you do contest the commissioner, even when the commissioner has maybe the publicity and some emotional feelings on his side. This is what you do when you're the chief of a union. You represent your players, whether they're champions or whether they're in trouble or both.
Lester Munson, you always do as good a job as can possibly be done explaining this in ways that all of us who don't know anything about it can fully understand. Thanks for the time this morning.
Thank you, Mike and Mike.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
The big question in sports today is this. Now that we know charges will not be filed against Ben Roethlisberger in Georgia, what will the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, do? He will be under a microscope, perhaps unlike any he has faced since he became the commissioner when it comes to issues of the conduct policy. So let's bring in Chris Mortensen here, our NFL insider extraordinaire on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline, and go through this thing with a guy who really knows the history of it as well as anybody. So, Mort, good morning. Let's just start with a prediction, and then we'll get more specific. What do you expect to happen at this meeting between Ben Roethlisberger and Roger Goodell?
Well, predictions on these matters are treacherous territory, so that's what it has to be taken as. My expectation is that Ben Roethlisberger will be disciplined to the level of some sort of suspension. Now, I don't know if that's going to come from the team or the league and or both, and that's kind of critical because I heard you guys mention the union's involvement in this. When a team suspends a player for conduct detrimental to the team, the player through the union, and that would, by the way, that would take Ben telling the union, yes, we want to appeal this, then it can go to an independent arbitrator. When the commissioner suspends you and you appeal it, it goes back to the commissioner. And we all know how that generally works out. So therefore, I expect Commissioner Goodell, based on when you apply, look at the personal conduct policy, and you guys have gone over it, and it clearly allows, and in fact it states that simply avoiding a conviction or a charge or whatever is not enough. It mentions conduct that undermines or puts to risk the integrity and reputation of the NFL, NFL clubs, and NFL players. I believe there will be a suspension, and I believe a quarterback who's won two Super Bowls, who's a face of one of your five-star franchises is going to be held to a higher level of accountability in terms of that so-called phrase we've used, that commissioner has used, protecting the NFL shield.
If he does get suspended, would we're talking about other players that were suspended under this policy. Would this be the least somebody has done to get suspended? What are some of the others that we're getting all kind of email, Mort, about people that have, others that have not been, charges pressed or anything filed against them, but and we're trying to figure all that out. Would he be
least? See, I'll go back to what Rogers told me and what he's told other people, which is it's always a case-by-case basis. There's no – in fact, that's why I think there's specific – you know, in other words, there's no list of here's a long list of things that you better stay away from. And so, you know, you could say maybe it's the least, but I know this much, and I agree with Lester Munson, who, by the way, I used to work with at the National Sports Daily, as an aside, and Lester's wonderful. The DA, Fred Bright, yesterday, I thought, provided the commissioner with much more detail than anybody imagine, including, I would say, the league office. And so the commissioner has his, you know, security director, Milt Ulrich, gather all that information. I'm sure they had a lot of the fax machine was working yesterday, or the PDFs through the email, whatever they do. And, you know, the commissioner and the league will be armed with as much detail as they can when they meet today, by the way. And, you know, one thing that Ben's got to do with his representatives, and David Cornwell is the chief representative in this matter, and he's handled a lot of matters for players when they've entered the commissioner's office, is Ben's got to explain how he got himself involved in another incident, even if the first incident was even more sketchier than this. And number two is, what plans does Ben have to avoid a situation like this? And even then, that may not be enough, because at the very least, by the way, let's say he isn't suspended. We know he's going to be ordered into, I mean, you just talk about a prediction I'm sure of, is that he'll be ordered into a clinical evaluation because of the amount of the booze that was involved. I mean, the DA says, you know, Ben bought, you know, alcohol shots for everybody. In fact, the DA says everyone agrees the woman was highly intoxicated. Now, he didn't say whether Ben was, but that knowing that a young lady was highly intoxicated, led by his bodyguard to a bathroom, and Ben falls in the bathroom, and the DA says questions persist, you know, he's going to be ordered into some type of evaluation, and that could put him in the program for random testing. But that's away from the possibility of a suspension, and I just believe that he's going to be held to an even higher standard because of who he is in this case.
I guess my point is a couple. Would the commissioner set a precedent by suspending Ben because of the least amount that he has done? I guess that's where I was going to, where the commissioner would have to think about it as well, saying, okay, now we're really, you know, again, no charges twice for this guy, so legally he hasn't done anything wrong. And yet, so if I suspend him, am I now opening up a little bit of, boy, you really maybe not have to do a whole lot to get suspended?
Well, I mean, I think the commissioner's made that clear, that the legal part of it, he's felt before that, you know, that players, you know, manipulating around the legal system, although this was not a manipulation because you could tell the DA had a thorough investigation, certainly.
Right.
You know, you could make that case, Mike, no question about it. This would be the less, but at the same time, when you look at the personal conduct of policy and you read the CBA, which allows the commissioner a large latitude, and even mentions conduct detrimental to the integrity or public confidence in the game of professional football, then maybe you can characterize it as the least of everybody that's been penalized. But with the latitude he has, you know, he certainly can impose that type of disciplinary action.
Mike and Mike, Chris Mortensen, there's one other factor in this that needs to be considered and may very well wind up being one of the most significant factors in it all. I want to ask you about that, Mort. Can you hang on a minute?
Absolutely.
Our NFL insider Chris Mortensen continues with us with perspective on what Commissioner Goodell may do with Ben Roethlisberger. And, Mort, I'm going to read something from Ron Cook's piece in this morning's Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He writes, Roger Goodell is scheduled to meet with Roethlisberger. There is tremendous pressure on Goodell, some of it racial pressure, to take a tough position with Roethlisberger. The commissioner has earned something of a reputation for being a hanging judge in his disciplinary dealings with black players such as Michael Vick and Adam Pac-Man Jones. He has to know how it would look if he turned soft with a star two-time Super Bowl winning white quarterback who clearly has violated the league's personal conduct policy. Certainly, Ron Cook writes, the league's black players will be watching closely how Goodell handles the Roethlisberger situation. Mort, how much of that kind of pressure do you think the commissioner is feeling from those close to him right now?
Well, I think Ron Cook's last statement was probably closer to being the truth than the other parts, which the last part of that statement being that the league's black players are certainly going to monitor this. I do believe that to be true. I think Commissioner Goodell would be just as outraged with that perception that he's a hanging judge with the league's black players as he was listening to the district attorney's press conference yesterday. I might add that Steelers President Art Rooney II, according to Ed Bouchette of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, was described as furious after watching the news conference. So that news conference, I do believe, triggered a different level of sensory, so to speak. And so bottom line is that I think the facts and details of this case will make Commissioner Goodell as steadfast as he is in handling any other case, and I think he would feel extremely insulted by the perception that he is a hanging judge for the black players of this league. Bottom line is, 75 to 80% of the league players in this league are black, therefore a higher percentage get into trouble. There have been Caucasian players who have been suspended. However, that is a public perception, and you guys know what we all say about perception, and I do believe it's a perception among some players, even though there have been players that have objected to commissioner's heavy hand with the personal conduct policy. The commissioner's always turned back and said, listen, we put this policy together in consultation with a players' advisory committee, which consisted of, obviously, African-American players. So it's something that it's out there. We know it's out there. I don't think it will influence the commissioner. I think that I really believe that Ben may be held to a higher standard, as I stated before. Now, multiple incidents, that's what's going to be interesting, because I do believe David Cornwell, who's representing Ben with the commissioner, is going to provide as much evidence as he can, in which Roethlisberger has countersued the lady in the 2008 incident in Lake Tahoe to say that shouldn't even count as an incident. I'm not sure the commissioner is going to buy into that.
All right, Moore, before we let you go, the amount of games you think he may be suspended?
Well, I'll say anywhere from 2 to 4 games. Remember, Brandon Marshall was suspended 3 games and then later reduced to 1. It's something along those lines. But, again, that's based on just an expectation. It's not based on any information I have right now.
All right, there's Chris Mortensen, who his educated guesses, I think, are as good as any we could ever possibly get. Mort, thank you for the perspective. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, guys, take care.
You're listening to the best of Mike and Mike in the Morning on ESPN Radio Pod Center.
We're very pleased to be welcome for the remainder of the hour here. We'll talk a bunch of baseball with baseball tonight's very own Bobby Valentine. Everybody say hi to Bobby V today. How are you, Bob?
Good, Michael.
It is a pleasure to see you, and one of the things I've always enjoyed, we spent a little time together down at ESPN on the weekend, getting into the psychology of coaching, in your case, managing, is that I've always felt, having watched your career closely,
that I needed a psychiatrist.
Well, perhaps. I think almost unquestionably. And people would say that because you are the definition of the outside-the-box thinker, right? There is sort of a mentality that almost everyone has, and then there are a few people who exist sort of outside of that. Where did that come from? How did that start for you? Is that something you do purposely?
I don't think I do it purposely. I think it's just part of my DNA, you know, and when we were playing in the state championship baseball game, I was also the lead in the class play. And when I was, knocking heads in the football play, I was running for class president. So I was always kind of in both worlds, if you would, and I just can't stay confined to one little place.
Is today's game managed much differently than when you were managing?
Well, it seems like it's different. When I was playing, it's definitely different.
Well, sure.
When Reggie was playing, it was definitely different, or is different. And it seems since I left 6 years ago that there's a little different mentality out there. There's a lot less guys going for it, a lot more sitting back and worrying about maybe what the general manager is going to say after the game, you know. And as soon as you get to the point of managing a baseball game, when you're worried about how you're going to answer the questions after the game, that's the time to get out and get a new job.
Well, obviously, in a market like this one, I would think there would be some, if there was any place that you were going to think that way, it would be here, managing the Mets all those years that you did. There is nowhere that there is the amount of attention and scrutiny on every move that you make like there is here. Was that something you thought about when you were, did you never think that to yourself? You're sitting on the dugout bench and you're saying to yourself, I'm going to go take him out. And then after the game, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to get blistered.
You know, the only time I thought about it and I became very uncomfortable with it was when I managed Nolan Ryan and was thinking about taking him out of the game in Texas. And when Mike Piazza didn't play. When I managed in New York, when he was sitting on the bench and I knew he needed a day off, and that situation would arrive in the sixth or seventh inning when I needed a big pinch hit, whether or not to give him the complete day off, save him for the ninth inning, how you're going to answer the question of why didn't you use Mike? And that was basically the only time I remember.
You know, that brings up something, Mike, but we opened this morning. It's just an interesting thing. Mm. Joe Girardi, the manager of the Yankees, said he was going to take CC Sabathia out of a game with two out. He failed to get the third out in the eighth inning, but he had a no-hitter going, and he gave up a base hit with two outs in the eighth. He had thrown 111 pitches at that point. He had 115 pitch count in mind, the manager did. Joe Girardi says that was going to be his last batter no matter what happened. Would you take a pitcher out of a game, taking all the situation into account, with a no-hitter working going into the ninth inning?
Well, you know, I managed Nolan Ryan's sixth and seventh no-hitter. I played in his first no-hitter, and I took him out in the seventh inning of a no-hitter.
You did?
Yes, when he was pitching for me.
What month of the season? Was it early April?
First month, first game. He only pitched seven innings in spring training. He had over 120 pitches after seven. There was no way he was going to complete it. I said, can you give me six pitches, two more innings? He says, I think it might take more than that. I said, well, then what do you think? You're out of there. I'm not sure that Joe takes him out of the game. If he has an easy inning going in, it's the eighth inning. To say you would is one thing. 111 pitches. I mean, 111 pitches. Some guys have that in the fifth inning. What? They're going to let them pitch the sixth inning at times, you know. I know it's early in the season. That would have been a very interesting thing. I think he would have left him in.
Plus, CC has been known to do that a bit. Yeah. Some complete games and throw more than that. Did Nolan fight you at all?
No, Nolan did not fight.
He did not.
No, he probably second-guessed me after the game, as most players do. But,
sure. Yeah.
Well, why the hell did he take me out? Yeah. I could have fit it. No, actually, he didn't do that.
What was he like to me? Let's have a little fun here. We've got plenty of time, so we can let it breathe a little bit. You have managed, played with, and managed some of the biggest stars in the history of the game. Nolan Ryan is the swashbuckling type. He's like the John Wayne of baseball.
Yeah.
What was he like to manage?
Well, he was a great guy to have on the team. There's no doubt about that. To manage was not an easy situation because he always wanted to stay in the game. As a matter of fact, this is an interesting situation. He was the icon, the 40-year-old that everyone loved. They packed the park wherever he pitched while he was doing this. And, you know, it got to a situation where I'd go to the mound, I'd bring in the left-hander, he'd walk off the mound, there would be a standing ovation, the left-hander would be given the ball, I would then proceed off the mound, they'd be still standing, but they wouldn't be giving me an ovation, you know what I mean? I'd get off. So it was one of these things, hey, Nolan, listen, here's the deal. You're not going to complete all the games, I'll come out, I'll take you out, but you'll wait until the reliever gets there. And I give the ball to the reliever. We walk off together. Cool idea? And
he said,
absolutely. Never did it.
Oh, that is great.
Another 10 times they took him out of the game. He walked off. He got the ovation, and I got the sea cushions thrown at me.
That is funny. Do you have to establish as a manager yourself right away with how you're going to do business and not get into, you know, you go out and you talk and have discussions, but at some point there has to be the word and someone listens to the word. So how much give and take can there be?
Well, I don't think there's any give and take as whether or not you're coming out of the game. That decision has to be made
right
before you leave the dugout. And as a matter of fact, I would have my pitching coach go out and take the guy out of the game so that if he had anything to say, I'd be waiting for him in the dugout as soon as he got into the dugout. We could discuss it there rather than out in the middle of the diamond before 50,000 in a national TV audience. But, you know, the discussion before you go out there were times, matter of fact, Nolan Ryan's last no-hitter, there was a discussion before the game started. That discussion was he wiped off his head. He got through his bullpen. The team is out on the field. He always had the routine where he would be the last one out on the field. As he's toweling himself off and putting his hat on, he looked at me and said, you better have someone ready. I think Big Tex is through.
Wow.
He went out to the mound. The pitching coach came into the dugout, and he said, he has nothing. He can't reach the mound. This is it. It's over. Struck out the first hitter, went on and pitched the no-hitter that game.
Unbelievable.
So there was a discussion before.
Oh, Mike, wow. And Mike and Bobby Valentine, who is as good talking baseball as anybody, stays with us for the hour. We'll take a short timeout, and we'll continue with more with Bobby V as we go on from the Zone next. Mike and Mike in the morning.
ESPN Radio.
We're live at ESPN Zone in Manhattan this morning, Times Square. Yankees home opener. Fans trying to get a Yankee chant going here.
Yeah, they're working it.
Bobby Valentine from Baseball Tonight is on our set with us talking baseball. Next issue we wanted to get into with you.
Yes.
Is umpiring.
Yes.
I don't want to umpire.
No, okay. Well, no one's asking you.
Who would want to umpire?
Well,
about it for a second.
If you don't want to umpire, that means you don't want to be the center of attention. That is my point, Bobby. I am. It drives me nuts. Nuts how these umpires, you know, you're supposed to be seen and not heard other than strike one, strike two, you're out or whatever. I have seen some, we were just in Pittsburgh, they gave us great seats there, we were 8 rows back of the home plate, and we saw a couple of the umpire ring up a couple of guys, and they kind of had a comment for him and then walked away, and the ump would follow them. Take his mask off, and he's the one who continued it.
No question, he was escalating the dialogue.
It's
no question.
Stunning to me, and I'm not going to say all umpires, but I see it more than a few who, boy, they seem to want to be the center of attention, and I don't understand why baseball lets that happen.
Well, maybe it's to speed up the game. I don't know. I can't figure
that's
out.
That's Joe
why
West's idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real tough profession. When you think about being a minor league umpire, they spend 8, 9, 10 years with no home base. They travel every day. They live out, some of them live out of vans, but they, you know, in and out of hotels every day of the year, waiting for the attrition to set in because you don't get fired.
Right.
You know, it's a judgeship once you get to the major leagues. So to get to the major leagues, you have to have someone retire or die or
right,
go crazy.
Right.
You know, so it's a really long, long wait for them. When they get there, it's then their place in the sun. Many of these guys are terrific baseball people, love the game, really enjoy what they're doing, and some of them do try to steal the show, have that idea that I spent so much time in the minor leagues and I'm not getting paid for it, and you are, and I don't like that. And you know, and that gets to be a little
aggravates.
Yeah.
Well, I can't tell you how much it
aggravates. Because Mike comes from a sport where in football,
yes,
where you yell like crazy at the ref, he's holding me or whatever it is, and the ref just stands there, blinks, and says nothing. In baseball, you've lived it. You're there. We think we know exactly what's going on in the field, but you actually do know from the standpoint of a player and the standpoint of a manager. Just how much do you see it happen? Has it happened to you where you've made a comment and then the umpire will escalate whatever the discussion might become?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and sometimes they're not really truthful. You know, one time I asked the umpire if I could get thrown out for what I was thinking. You know? He said no, and I said, well, I'm thinking you're really a lousy umpire, and then he threw me out. Seriously, there are some guys who are confrontational. There's no doubt. And you know who they are going in. And you try to keep your confrontational players away from them as much as possible. But, you know, you go out the field to either help your team win or protect your players, you know, integrity, if mm-hmm. you will, make him feel like you're with him. And that's the only time you ever really should be arguing with him.
Whenever I bring it up, though, there are those that will say, hey, it's part of the game. People love watching the confrontation between a player and an umpire or a manager and an umpire. The old, you know, when they're spinning their hats and spitting on each other and kicking dirt. Really? Am I missing something there? I mean, is that looked forward to by people? I'm just still amazed baseball, Bud Selig and baseball, you know, allow some of that stuff to happen.
Sometimes that fires up the crowd or fires up the team, but I don't think that it's really a necessary part of the game.
Mike and Mike, Bobby Valentine as well. There's another thing that's been a big topic of conversation here and in general lately has been competitive balance in Major League Baseball, which, in my honest opinion, I think they have done as good a job of trying to restore or create more competitive balance as probably can be done under the current circumstances. You managed in Japan for a really long time where, I mean, they take their baseball as seriously there as we take it here, and it is a very significant major league in baseball. What is the competitive balance situation like in Japan?
Oh, there is none.
There's none.
No, they have.
It's financially
Absolutely.
Miss Barrett.
Two power teams. They get the best players, draw the most people, and make all the money. And they have no revenue sharing. They have no sharing of talent. They have a common draft, but it's a weird draft where you can the first round is a lottery pick. So everyone can pick the same guy, and then the lucky winner gets that number one draft. So there's no way of really having a feeder system to bring the bottom up. So we have a, at least we have revenue sharing here.
Right, right.
We have a situation in baseball where really with the playoff system, when you think that the Marlins have already won two world championships, when you think of all the different teams that are in the playoffs each year, it's, I think, a very competitive situation.
And that's, baseball certainly brings that up, and it bears out by seeing who has made the postseason, but some people just have a hard time getting over forgetting the Yankees if they're over 200, but, you know, the Cubs are, what, 146. There are certainly a number of teams up high like that, and then 34 by the Pittsburgh Pirates, 40 or 50 by someone. Is there a better way? Is there a better way to get this thing done?
Well, I think it works pretty good. I don't think that, I don't think caps work. I'm not a big cap fan, only because in football, for the most part, the same teams are always there, and they have a cap. You know, and when you had that New England run, that was during the cap season, and New England was always the champion. You know,
yeah.
So it's an interesting situation where you play enough of games to weed out the weak, and sometimes the weak are the rich, as has been the case in even in the other team in New York, if you will, and the Dodgers when they were spending all the money, or when some of these teams just thought they could buy a pennant, and then the $30 million, you know, Florida Marlins win the championship.
Yeah, the Cubs obviously are a high spending team, haven't won the World Series in a century, and there's no question you can't just look at it and say, okay, spend money equals win championships.
Right.
We get that. But I think we've been all over the country in the last week, and there are a lot of fans out there that look at this crowd out here right now, and they say, you know, look at the Yankee fans, and they've got all of the best players in baseball, and they'll wind up getting the next ones who become free agents also, and that's a system that a lot of fans around the country find very frustrating.
They find it frustrating, but it's been such a part of the baseball culture and fabric forever. You know, remember the Yankees bought Babe Ruth.
Right.
Remember the Sporting News, if you look back at the history of baseball, always reads baseball on the decline in the 30s. Yankees have too much money in the 40s. How can you buy another pennant in the 50s? So this has been a continuing theme of baseball, and baseball's theme has gone on.
Mike and Mike, Bobby Valentine is here. We'll keep him a few more minutes as we continue. We'll look at what we've seen in the first week of the baseball season. How much of it should we be paying attention to, and how much of it will we have forgotten by the time we get to Memorial Day? More with Bobby V next. Mike and Mike in the morning.
ESPN Radio.
With Bobby Valentine now from Baseball Tonight. So looking at the first week of the season, a couple of things that jump out at us, two that we'll get to here and get your perspective. One, Albert Pujols, even by his standards, off to a ridiculous start. And the San Francisco Giants.
Yeah.
Now, granted, they've probably not played the better teams in the National League to start their season. But their pitching looks even better than we thought, and they look that they may have a little more offense than we thought. How legit do we think they might be?
I think they are legit. I did pick them. I like their pitching a lot. They are scoring runs, more runs than the Phillies, as you all know, thus far. But I'm not sure they catch the ball as well as they have to be a championship team. They're going to have to improve their defense a little, and I'm sure that Bruce Bochy out there will work on that. He's a terrific manager, and I'm pulling for him.
How do you, as a manager, break up seasons? You know, right now we're just 7 games in, so how do you break it up?
I always try to break it up. About 60 games, 2 months into the season, you should have your team in the competition down. You know what you're doing. You know what you have to do. You've made your moves. You know your minor leagues. You understand if the young guys are ready right now. You understand if your veterans are finished or if they're going to give you another year. And then you play that middle part of the season to get to where you have to be, and then you put the throttle down with no holes barred at the end of the season.
Mike, again, it's so incredibly early, but the numbers that Pujols has put up so far, the best start to a season that we've seen since Dale Murphy and Willie Mays, the only guys who ever had started a season as fast as he has. In your time in baseball, have you seen a better hitter than Albert Pujols?
I don't think so. You know, A-Rod obviously was dominating. Barry Bonds was fascinating, you know, to watch. But Barry took a lot more than Albert does. Albert has more pitches that he hits harder than Barry did. And he's just phenomenal. I mean, he hits them over the fence. I don't know where you would pitch to him and why you would pitch to him. And now they have Holiday behind him, so it makes it a little a little more interesting.
So 10 years in the league for him and a kid just starting his career. There's a couple pitchers out there, but Jason Hayward wins the spot right off the bat with Atlanta. First, you know, at bat, three-run shot. And all you hear is great things about this kid and his patience at the plate for such a big hitter early on.
Yeah, it's a patient thing, but it's also a recognition thing. That's, I guess they go hand in hand. He's a tall guy. He's like John Olerud was, like you. And I think they really have an advantage. I think when you're up there at 6'6", that you have an advantage seeing the ball coming in. They don't have a double perspective of you. It's a long story, but he sees it early. He takes it early, and he swings early. I also shook hands with him. His hand comes up to here.
Really?
On my hand. Your the only form. Guy who had a handshake like his that I ever shook was Willie Mays. Had the same grip that just paralyzed you when your hand was in his hand.
Wow.
He's Mike, a special kid.
Mike, Bobby Valentine, one more thing for you. We opened the conversation by saying you're always sort of an outside-the-box thinker. Who was the manager that you thought, when you went up against him, was the most... was the toughest to manage against? The most cerebral...
Billy Martin.
Billy Martin, why?
Because Billy Martin... It was a competition with Billy Martin. You know, when he was thinking, he'd look across and see what I was thinking. And if something ever worked out, there were a couple times, I remember one time in Texas, where there, you know, it was a pinch hit, a different pitching move, a fake squeeze, a miss squeeze, a hit and run, and it worked. And he actually tipped his hat from his dugout over to my dugout. You know,
really?
Like the competition was there. He was always into it. He never missed a trick. And, you know, Tommy Lasorda was the most fun because he was my mentor, and I got to manage against him, and he was also a fabulous manager.
We could do this, Mike.
Boy, that is
we could
something.
Do this for hours and hours and weeks and weeks. Huh. What a pleasure to have you here. Bobby, thank you so
Thanks,
much for
Bobby.
Coming down.
I'm a fan. You guys do great. Thank you.
Bobby Valentine, there's no one better to sit and talk baseball with. What a terrific thing it is for us at ESPN to have him now on Baseball Tonight.